It's time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Well, once again, good morning for a Thursday morning, and back in the studio after a break last week to visit family out west. Speaking of west, southwest Saskatchewan, we normally think of as a drier area, but Gould Town, I've not been there, but it's over in that southwest region, with almost 3 inches of rain, they led the parade. And the good news is that almost everyone got some rain, but in most cases not enough. So that's the way the crop report stacks up this week. Also on the program today, water, important in a lot of industries, vital if you're an aerial applicator, and local Mycar area coming up with an interesting source. Pea and protein, pea and pulse crop for protein concentrate and extraction. It continues to be kind of a lead story in the agriculture world these days. Well, most of the province did receive at least a small amount of rain, as we mentioned, with Gould Town the most. On the other hand, of course, everyone knows that wind is continuing to dry out the topsoil moisture, although we had a calmer day yesterday and not too bad so far today. Now, the moisture levels on cropland remain about the same as last week, with hay and pasture land reduced slightly. And, of course, that would be where people didn't get much rainfall. Cropland topsoil moisture, 2% surplus, and 69% is adequate, 22% short, 7% very short. The topsoil moisture for hay and pasture is 55% adequate, so about half. So we still need some rain almost everywhere, as you'll hear. Now, crop and pasture development has improved with some of that rain, and the reporters say that crop development is about at its normal development stage for this time of year for most of the crops. And, of course, there are exceptions. These are all about averages. Well, out of all those winds from south of the 49th parallel, unwelcome visitors, and in this case not COVID cases, a larger than normal number of diamondback moths and aster leaf hoppers blown into the province. Aster yellows and their leaf hopper hosts are native to areas along the Gulf of Mexico, but ride our way almost yearly on those strong southerly winds.
One of the hypotheses that we're looking at is, are they doing long-distance migrations? Are they, say, coming up all the way from Mexico on the winds, on one big wind, or are they sort of getting onto that wind train partway up, Omaha and Nebraska, or somewhere out in the Pacific Northwest? Maybe they're getting on from the Yakima Valley in Washington. And so when we look at those reverse trajectories of the winds, we try to see where that say, hopping onto the wind train could be happening.
So that's Tyler Weist with Ag Canada, obviously a specialist on these pests. So there is a sense of urgency.
Well, for the diamondback moth, we have pockets of resistance to some insecticides. And so if they come from an area where there's known resistance, then we'll have a better idea of what not to use. And for the leaf hoppers, if they're coming from a cropping area where we know there are a lot of aster yellow symptoms or really good host plants for aster yellows, then that's another reason why we want to know where those leaf hoppers are coming from.
And of course, those leaf hopper guys might carry disease referred to as aster yellow.
You can have hundreds of leaf hoppers in your field, but if they're not carrying the disease, then there's no problem having the leaf hoppers in your field. But if they are carrying the disease, we can figure it out. And so that's another reason why we're capturing leaf hoppers from across the province, to try to figure out if they are infected with aster yellows or not.
I know you can't put a percentage on it, but is it a majority that are not infected or are infected, or can you say one way or the other? Or?
You know, in most years, the majority are uninfected when they come up here. If we remember back to 2012, which was the last really bad aster yellows year, and we look back on the percentage of leaf hoppers that were infected, we had about 10% of the leaf hoppers that were infected, which is unusual when usually it's less than 1% of the leaf hoppers. And so that was one of the factors for having that 2012 Aster Yellows outbreak.
So that Tyler Weist conversation with colleague Neil Billinger of Saskatoon CJWW. The Ford Farm just east of Yorkton for generations was well known and justly famous as a dairy operation. It's now a straight grain farm. With Dennis Dick, manager here at The Rock, we completed our spring 2020 visit schedule Wednesday, and we spoke with Glenn Ford.
You're grain farming?
Yes, we're grain farm. We grain farm around 4,700 acres.
And so this year, what does that consist of?
Wheat, barley, oats, and canola.
Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned that you do some of the farming with the Farming for Health organization?
Yeah, we do the flip year on the Health Foundation land, so they get a third of the crops.
Yeah, yeah. So it's obviously dry. What have you had for rain, if anything, since April 1st?
We just had a half an inch be 2.5 weeks ago, so with this wind and stuff, it's really dried out, and that's gone now, and we're desperate needed for rain now. So
right. So who's involved in the operation these days?
My brother Leonard and myself, and Trisha and Dustin, that's Leonard's kids, and my two kids, Jordan and Cameron.
Hmm.
And my wife, Cindy, and Lori. Lori does meals, and Cindy actually helps combine and stuff during harvests.
Yeah. So who's the CEO?
Well, that's mom and dad. They're still the boss, I guess. So. And they're involved, of course, still, too, but slowing down and stuff. So.
Yeah, okay. So the Ford Dairy was established, was it in the 20s? Or?
My great-grandfather moved up from the other side of the border, Montana, in the late 30s.
And who was he?
That was Nelson.
Nelson.
Senior, I guess you'd call
him. Yeah, okay.
And then my grandpa took over, and my dad took over, and now my and Leonard's kids are the fifth generation on the farm here. So,
so at one time, this was a major dairy operation. How many cows would the group have been milking, et cetera?
We milked an average of 130, roughly. We were up to 160 at one point, I guess, but not for very long. So.
Yeah. So can you tell me about the decision to get out of dairy?
A lot to do with the trade issues and stuff, and, you know, that's about it, I guess.
Yeah. So where did your herd go to?
A farm north of Saskatoon. They want to get up to 400 or 600 cows, I think. So they went to a good home, as we understand. So,
yeah. I can't imagine what it took to make that decision.
Well, boy, it was sure nice not getting up at 3:30 in the morning to milk cows. That's for sure.
Yeah, you're right.
But I'm still getting up at 5:30 to. Well, this morning was 4:30 to go and spray. So.
Yeah. And how's that going right now?
Actually, just finished up this morning, so hopefully we don't have to worry about doing any more, and hopefully we get some rain now. So,
right. So my garden, I was saying to some of your family, it's very dry and it hasn't even shown much weed growth. So what's happening out in your fields?
Well, that's one thing I noticed compared to some neighbors. We pre-sprayed everything this spring before seeding, and it sure kept the ground nice and clean. So something like Invigor Canola, you usually have to do two passes of Liberty, so we got away with one pass of Liberty. So it saves a little bit of money there.
Yeah.
Roundup's $4 an acre, and Liberty and Centurion's $14 an acre, $15. So it's well worth the money spraying before you seed, just to keep the weed competition down, especially in this dry year, so the weeds aren't pulling the moisture and nutrients. So,
yeah. So as you see things going ahead, is there another generation that may take over the farm?
Well, for sure, my oldest son Jordan, he just loves sitting in that seat and loves driving that tractor and combine. And Trisha kind of likes the cows a bit. We do have 35 beef cows yet, and that's about it.
What do you think great grandpa and those people would have thought of about the way we farm today and the operation?
Well, yeah, sure. Changed, like I was saying earlier, that, you know, in, back in the 80s where you worked everything and dried it right out, now the zero-till practices, the moisture's there and the crop actually is staying pretty good so far, but, you know, it definitely needs a rain. But if I would have told my grandpa that a combine's $1 million, he would have dropped dead from a heart attack right there and then.
Of course. Okay, great. Super.
So that was a conversation yesterday morning with Glenn Ford. Glenn, by the way, once was a student for my wife at the Yorkton Regional High School. No doubt that's why he's done such a great job at farming. And this more or less wrapped up our current farm visit series, and we were supplied not only with McDonald's coffee, but the newest product introduction from the company, McDonald's Donuts. And, of course, I have to sample those, so it's one of those tough jobs I have. And we also thank Yorkton Auction Center, Murray Arnold of Hammond Realty, Pathway Supply, and Value Tire, our co-sponsors for this this series, and also all the farmer operators who welcomed us and did our best to be socially distanced for these coffee chats. Well, one other on-the-land visit recently found James Hansen with wrenches in hand just east of Ebenezer, working on one of several vehicle projects there. So with coffee in hand and muffins consumed, we have on the land cranked up the question machine again, beginning with this year's crop and when it was seeded.
Started when it warmed up. Exact date?
First week in May?
I think 15th of May.
Yeah? Was it kind of dry?
A little bit. Not bad. I dried seeds, so it's not really that dry, but just waiting for the soil to warm up.
Yeah. And now we just came down the lane there. It looks like something green coming up across the way. So is it all emerged now?
Yeah, it's looking pretty good, actually.
Yeah. So what sort of mix and rotation would you be using?
I've got canola, peas, wheat, and oats. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of rotate through those.
Right. So what about moisture so far? Have you had some rain here?
We had 1 millimeter last night. And we had an inch last week, Sunday, Monday. But it's dry. Mm. It's really dry.
Right. But obviously there was moisture there to get the crop going?
And everything that didn't get disturbed before you seeded, yeah, it was great. Yeah. Anything you pre-worked or even harrowed, it dried out pretty fast.
Yeah, right.
When you got tornado winds, it dries fast.
Right. As far as your career now, we're surrounded by projects you've got here. You're obviously a mechanic type of a guy as well. So just talk about that as far as from a farming point of view.
Oh, man. Well, if you're a small farmer these days, you sure can't afford new iron. So you have projects.
Mm-hmm.
You build stuff. First direct seeding air seeder I built myself back when Roundup was really expensive. You learn to work on things.
Yeah. So, and what do you seed with now?
I use a seed master now.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Seed placement, accuracy, very little disturbance. Everything's exactly where you want to put it.
Right. So James, we talked a couple of years ago about drones. You took a course, and I was interested in your take on using drones and farming. It gets a bit complicated.
Well, it's not horribly complicated. The software is very easy to use. The technology is easy to use. It just takes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. And so are you currently using drones in your diagnostics and your crop watch and so forth?
Very occasionally, but it still doesn't, it cannot replace just going out walking around the field.
Okay, as I mentioned, it's okay. We'll just put this on pause here. Picking this up again with James Hansen. So, James, you've taken over a family farm operation. Just give me that background.
Well, great-grandfather homesteaded here in 1888.
What was his name?
August Zimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather, John Zimmer, and me.
So when did you, let's say, begin your farming career? Because you also have had a career in X-ray.
around 1988, my grandfather passed away and started here.
Right. So was it, I'm thinking about the fact that you were am I going to call you an x-ray technician?
Sure.
Yeah. You fixed x-ray machines and, no?
X-rayed people.
X-rayed people, but you also fixed machinery.
Oh, always have. Fixed everything.
So it was natural to come to the farm. So you learned on the job about fixing machinery and farming.
No, I started working on cars when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Been pulling wrenches since I've been 12.
Yeah. So you're in the process of building a shop here, a new shop. What did you have for a facility when you first started farming?
Well, in 86, we built this shop. By 1988, everything we used in the farm grew bigger, and nothing could fit in the shop. So I'm tired of kneeling on the ground working on stuff, so I'm building on going 20-foot ceiling and 52 by 48.
And are you doing all the work yourself?
No, actually, I'm hiring the shop belt.
Okay.
I have no time for that.
Okay. Okay, there's a Volkswagen here in front of us. It's probably not your favorite project. Have you got a favorite project you're working on right now?
Well, I've got 89 Westphalia that's screaming my name.
What are you doing to it?
Oh, just going through it, getting ready to hit the road.
Yeah.
Got a bunch of old gas tractors. The list is endless. I have more projects than life.
Okay.
So there you have it. As you can see, we have a lot of fun and meet a lot of interesting people when we do these on-the-land visits. And that was recorded on June 17th with James Hansen about a week ago, of course. And, a guy that's handy with wrenches gets a lot of respect from me. Well, the current owners of Monsanto, we talked about Roundup briefly in those interviews, Bayer Ag on Wednesday announced some major financial settlements, which the company says will place the glyphosate debate where it belongs in science. As well, Bayer emphasized the agreements announced yesterday, quote, contain no admission of a liability or wrongdoing. A spokeswoman was quoted by Glacier Farm Media saying the agreements will bring greater certainty to farmer customers about the availability of our products, our being the Bayer and Monsanto people. But there will be no change in the availability for crop chemicals such as glyphosate and dicamba. Now, another official said basically every regulator in the world has approved glyphosate as safe and non-carcinogenic. Multiple regulators reaffirmed it, and in response to the WHO World Health Organization, they classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic to humans. But in essence, the company says, quote, we're paying an awful lot of money to take the discussion about the safety of glyphosate out of the courtroom and actually put it back in the scientific and regulatory arena because that's where it belongs. Now, Bayer expects to spend up to $12 billion in the next couple of years to resolve legal action taken against Monsanto. And Monsanto is now part of Bayer. I think farmers certainly get that. Of that $12 billion, somewhere between 10.1 and 10.9 billion will go to, quote, resolve current and potential future Roundup litigation. And that refers to about 125,000 lawsuits, both filed and unfiled so far. As well, Bayer emphasized the agreements they announced Wednesday contain no admission of liability or wrongdoing. You're listening to On the Land from the Rock. I'm Jack Dawes, back with more in a moment.
Due to restrictions brought on in response to COVID-19, overnight camping programs in much of Canada will not be permitted in the summer of 2020. Does that mean that One Hope Canada, known for 40 camps across the country, is closing down? Absolutely not. In some areas, day camps are permitted, so we will be running day camps in those areas. Where day camps are not permitted, we will be running a virtual camp using a brand new app that's being developed. Will you pray for us? One Hope Canada, online at onehopecanada.ca.
Did you hear that Ag in Motion is going virtual this year?
I heard, but I'll miss our yearly trip out there.
Yeah, but I'm excited. Everything will be online, even equipment demos and crop plot tours. Plus, I heard companies are offering deals and contests.
Sounds pricey.
It's free, and it's easy to register. I did this morning from my phone while I was in the field.
Get ready for Ag in Motion Discovery Plus, a virtual event bringing you the classics of Ag in Motion on demand and free of charge, July 21st to 25th. Register now at aginmotion.com.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
Well, there's been a lot of talk over the past week and several big announcements about protein extraction and the Merit Company based in Winnipeg now, or at least building a plant there, receiving some support through the super cluster. Well, a breeding line of oats from the University of Saskatchewan, the Crop Development Center, is part of a new breakthrough in the study of the oat genome, essentially the gene map of the oat plant. This week, PepsiCo and Corteva Agriscience announced the release of the first ever publicly available, now wait for it, hexaploid oat genome sequence. We'll explain that one shortly. Corteva supplied advanced sequencing technology and analytic capability, combined that with sequencing data from the University of North Carolina. The Crop Development Center oat variety OT3098 was used in this, and the data is made available on the USDA Agriculture Research Service Grain Genes website. The work completed in just 4 months. PepsiCo and Corteva say they are publicly releasing the genome sequence to continue the advance of oat research. Of course, we have the large capacity grain millers oat plant here in Yorkton. So for further insight, we spoke to grain millers director of crop science, Eric DeBleek. Now, he's actually in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, a district near Minneapolis.
Back up here, just a little bit. We've been working on genomic research in oats for quite a few years. What we're talking about isn't necessarily kind of a new big, you put that in quotations, a new big thing. It's still new and it's still a big deal. But it's been in the works for multiple years. When we look at mapping the oat genome, the work there was started, I can't put actual dates to it because it predates me, but roughly 10 years ago with the North American Core Project, which was funded by most of the big millers, and then the North American Millers Association was a part of it. I believe it was a partnership as well between AAFC and the USDA, I believe, was involved with it. Still a little bit before my time, so I don't have, super clear details on that. But what they did at that time was to start to break down the oat genome and kind of provide a roadmap to, or the way I think of it is as a roadmap to what the, kind of where certain traits lie within the genes and within these chromosomes. So it just allows us to go in there and kind of take a look at things and be like, well, this presence of DNA on this set of a chromosome relates to this trait in oats. So like high beta glucan or good standability, those type of things, and they're just kind of laying that all out there, and these traits we're just identifying where they're at, and what they might look like. So when, Pepsi and Corteva got together in partnership with North Carolina, the big news or the good news here is that they took an old variety that was bred by Aaron Beattie's program or the CDC in Saskatoon and fully mapped that variety. So they fully mapped that set of genetics that created that variety so they can more accurately compare that to other partial maps that have been created, and then use those maps to say, yep, these types of genes or these types of You know, this area of the gene map says, you know, you're going to get good yield. How do we incorporate that into identifying varieties or identifying and evaluating young germplasm so we know whether we should continue in the breeding process with it or we can just throw it out?
So Eric, if I can just jump in there, then does this tell us then that, all right, that we now can identify a gene and say, okay, this is going to give us higher beta glucans, so that we can specifically edit that gene, I guess is maybe one of the terms, or use it in that specific way? Are we there yet?
We're closer. If the consumer and the industry wanted to go that way, this type of information and having maps like this helps set up the industry to be able to do that. It doesn't necessarily mean that we can. It just gets us closer and gives us more of the tools to be able to do that if that's a desire. And the problem with those, and we talk about hexaploids, is they have, which just means there's six sets of chromosomes there. And the issue with this, from my understanding, is that some of these traits can have genes or can have pieces of information on all of these sets of chromosomes, and it isn't necessarily in exactly one place, which makes oats very difficult to work with, from my understanding.
That again, Eric DeBleek, he's the director of crop science with Grain Millers, and that is the Grain Millers who have a plant here in Yorkton, their head offices in Eden Prairie in Minnesota. Well, to draw the line from the needs of a Second World War air training base to a modern-day aerial application business would not seem obvious at first, but the link between the two is simple, and it is water. MyCar Aerial is based at Yorkton Airport, where hundreds of pilots trained as part of the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, BCATP for short, during the Second World War. That, of course, required a large and ready water supply into itself. So does the current aerial spraying operation MyCar. MyCar founder and president Michael Yelnitsky explains how the company has repurposed a large water storage vault, which once supplied the needs of the World War II base. Now, these days, the site is Carrigana-covered dirt mound just inside the airport grounds, where Mark MyCar and his partner air charter company Good Spirit Air leased the former airport terminal, which was a WW2 hangar, and they operate two other aircraft storage and maintenance buildings.
So, with Michael Yelnitsky, let's start then. All right, we're standing here beside this looks like a mound of dirt with a cement lid on it, but it's a water containment area. What's the backstory on how you came to use it?
Well, water in the aerial spray business is very important. I mean, it's one of the main things that we need as a resource. And so, with no water available, commercial water available, and no reservoirs here, we were forced to haul water for all the years, and that worked fine. But the cost of maintaining trucks and trailers, and just the cost of having a person. I mean, sometimes on a busy day in a spray season, we would go through up to 10 semi-loads of water in a day. So being aware that there was a reservoir here during the war effort, but never really having examined it, we took one of the lids off a little over a year ago, and I crawled inside, and gosh, I mean, it was very, very well built concrete water cistern for the flight training effort. And so I wrote a letter to the city and requested that we would be able to lease it. And it took a while, but the city responded positively, and they also allowed us to dig a reservoir in sort of land that's not going to interfere with flight operations or the agricultural operations here at the airport. And so
natural low spot.
Yeah, a natural low spot. So with the agreement to go ahead, we dug the reservoir this year in March, and then we shallow buried lines, which are going to be for seasonal, and we got inside and pumped out and cleaned out and washed out the cisterns. And there's four silos that are 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet, solid concrete, interconnected. And it's just a rock solid facility for water containment. And so.
So, how many gallons? Give me an idea of how much water that is.
It's about 100,000 gallons total capacity if it's right full. And our reservoir is about 400,000 gallons. The only problem is our reservoir only really got about a third filled this spring because we had, an unusual thaw. There was a lot of freeze drying, and so we didn't get the runoff into the low spot that we had expected. And you know, if we probably had a good 1-inch rain, we would replenish our reservoir. But it's it's still running a little low. But we have been able to fill this reservoir once, and we are pumping water into our spray operation tanks.
So what sort of a job was it cleaning it up?
I'm really not, just like cleaning any water tank. I mean, just a bigger tank. I mean, and the thing is, it's just that it was dark and some of the, but we had lanterns and we used the pressure system and we had Sheldon with his sewage truck sucking out the sludge. I mean, it was just, over years of settlement, but it is rock solid. I mean, the workmanship that went into building that containment for water was unbelievable.
Interesting. I know there was a reunion here from the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, and I don't think anyone realized this facility was here, but obviously it was crucial to the war effort.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, the monument you're talking about is right over there. I mean, it's probably, 150 feet away. Because they covered it with soil for insulation, and I'm almost thinking they planted the carraganas purposely because it's got, just a thick grove of carraganas covering it. And so there's two bunkers on this east side, and then there's about 12 feet of dirt between them, and then another bunker with two concrete tanks, and there's an interconnected pipe in the ground between the two tanks.
Right, and then you feed this down to your on-flight operation.
So the theory is to pump water out of our reservoir, which has, it's still wind and sediment and algae, whatever. I mean, we pump it into here, it settles in here, and then from here we pump clean water to our spray operations. We have about 15,000 gallons of containment right on our site there, and so it'll work for us for seasonal operations.
That again, a conversation with Michael Yelnitsky of Mycar Aerial and Good Spirit Air. Now, the company includes 18 full-time employees plus some seasonal staff in spray season. The company maintains 8 spray-type ag tractors, 3 twin-engine King Air passenger airplanes, also operating out of sub-bases in Saskatoon and Flin Flon. So the need for water is obvious. The operation has been impacted heavily by the COVID pandemic. Here again is my conversation with Michael Yelnitsky.
So with Michael Yelnitsky, Michael, let's start then. All right, we're standing here beside this looks like a mound of dirt with a cement lid on it, but it's a water containment area. What's the backstory on how you came to use it?
Well, water in aerial spray business is very important. I mean, it's one of the main things that we need as a resource. And so, commercial water available, and no reservoirs here, we were forced to haul water for all the years, and that worked fine. But the cost of maintaining trucks and trailers, and just the cost of having a person. I mean, sometimes on a busy day in a spray season, we would go through, up to 10 semi-loads of water in a day. So being aware that there was a reservoir here during the war effort, but never really having examined it, we took one of the lids off a little over a year ago, and I crawled inside, and gosh, I mean, it was very, very well built concrete water cistern for the flight training effort. And so I wrote a letter to the city and requested that we would be able to lease it, and took a while. but the city responded positively, and they also allowed us to dig a reservoir in sort of land that's not going to interfere with flight operations or the agricultural operations here at the airport. And so
kind of a natural low spot.
Yeah, a natural low spot. So with the agreement to go ahead, we dug the reservoir this year in March, and then we shallow buried lines, which are going to be for seasonal, and we got inside and pumped out and cleaned out and washed out the cisterns. And there's four silos that are 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet, solid concrete, interconnected, and it's just a rock solid facility for water containment. And so
how many gallons are, give me an idea of how much water that is?
It's about 100,000 gallons total capacity if it's right full. And our reservoir is about 400,000 gallons. The only problem is our reservoir only really got about a third filled this spring because we had, an unusual thaw. There was a lot of freeze drying. And
that, again, we kind of doubled up on some audio there with Michael Yelnitsky, but we thought it an interesting story, and we kind of take it for granted with aerial applicators. Yeah, they need water. Well, where do you get it from? And that interesting storage unit they're using dates back to the Second World War, and apparently we had forgotten all about it. Well, we're fortunate to have on the line with us now our colleague Harry Siemens, who checks in with us almost every week. So, Harry, everyone in this part of the world is saying we could use more rain. You had parts of southern Manitoba that got too much. Can you bring us up to date on that situation now? Have we been able to assess, is there permanent crop damage from some of those big rainfalls down in that southeast corner from a couple of weeks ago?
It's interesting. They just extended the state of emergency in the municipality of Piney, which is right up there in the southeast part, and looking at what the Reeve had to, Wayne Anderson had to say, he said they were actually getting rain, and I'm going to try and get up there and then before next week's show, because they're still continuing to get rain, and he says and if they all of a sudden get a major rain event, and here's the, just painting a brief picture. He says we've got so many temporary roads, and he says that any another rain or weather event would absolutely wash all of them out again. So they have a really dire situation. The water has come up. It's really not gone down a lot. So obviously those crops, and I think the bigger challenge has also been that it's also livestock country. And he says when soil becomes saturated, any rain event causes more runoff. And that's, I think I've explained that once before. It's flat, as flat can be, and there isn't a lot of drainage other than some man-made drainage that has to go then, I think, all the way to the Red River and go from there. So it's a real tough challenge, and it goes further north. In fact, just as what I'm saying, even a couple of miles or so from Steinbach, Manitoba, just south of that. And so there's a huge area there. In fact, I've asked a pilot to see if he'll take me up there and see what some of the situation is like. But at the same time, we had other areas that had heavy, heavy rain. And there, too, I drove past some of that today, and it doesn't look pretty in any way, shape, or form. But then, of course, there are some areas that are looking really good. But really, we do also need rain in the rest of the park. And that's really the ironic situation, is that we have flooded area in the southeast and the rest of the province is dry. So, we've been getting little drops of moisture here and there. I just talked to Tom Tightrobe, and I'll have that interview actually for next week. He's that cattleman up in the Interlake, and he says in their case, the pastures and the hay crop, he says, is many, many times better than they've had in the last couple of years. He says the grain crops are looking for rain. and they had all that moisture. He said last fall, they had a drought up until last fall, and they had 16 inches of moisture last fall with snow, hail, and water and rain. And so right now, the grain crops are again looking for more.
So, Harry, it looks like, well, as always, there's a mixed bag of things going on, but from the Saskatchewan crop report today, although there are some tough areas, the crop development seems fairly normal, and in many parts there's been enough scattered rain showers here and there that overall the moisture conditions seem to be adequate so far, and the crop is coming along. Does that appear to be happening up in the Manitoba Northwest crop zone going up into the Swan River Valley, those areas? Do you have any connections or seen any tweets from farmers in that area?
In the Northwest, in the Swan Valley, I understand it's really dry. They're looking for moisture, but and also in the Interlake, even Tom told me this morning, that they've had since seeding, maybe 3/4 of an inch of rain, and 15 millimeters or so. And I think all over the place, except for the bigger rain events. But because we had such a full water table right across the province, the farmers are telling me and tweeting that their crops are holding. So with a little bit of moisture to fall here and there, and with the water table being that high, the roots are going down, and we're going to, I think, see a pretty decent crop. But again, we'll have to wait for the rest of the time because they'll need rain. As a researcher once told me years ago, he says a good crop of wheat, in order to maintain a full development, needs 1 inch of moisture every week and until it's mature. So that's kind of where I think we are at. Yeah, it looks good, but we need rain. But at the same time, the water table is feeding it from the bottom.
So, Harry, now, there's been a herbicide issue or issues that you picked up on?
I just saw the tweets 2 days ago. It's a chemical called Assert, and for whatever reason, it's because of weed tolerance or whatever that's called. Yeah,
yeah.
They've decided to take it off the market for a couple of years, and people can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going by memory, but that's kind of the gist of it. So the guys that are growing the conventional or sunflowers. And that's where I picked that up. All of a sudden, guys are back, and the one guy says, we can't use a chemical on our confectionery sunflower, so we're back to using iron. Because I saw the picture, and the guy made the point, it had been a long time since he had cultivated row crop. And so that's the issue, that it's been taken off the market. It has to do with the weed tolerance issue. And so they're going to, and I'm going to look at doing more for that for a future program, but that's the extent of it. And so one guy said, well, Jake Waldner, he's a Hutterite. He says, well, I've got all kinds of stuff. And then another guy from Ryan Dick from another company, he called and said, or tweeted, and he says, the only stuff you can now get is the stuff that's still in warehouses and storage. So whoever could find it, so. The next day, of course, they were seeing who could get there first.
So the use of iron is interesting, or that concept. So are they spraying on iron some product as a foliar fertilizer?
No.
Iron
means that they're back to row cropping, cultivating.
Oh, cultivating. Yeah, okay. Now I got it. Iron. Good.
See, just a brief comment. My father farmed sunflowers back in the middle 50s. He was one of the first to start in that area, and he had been into sugar beets. So for sugar beets, of course, you'd use manual labor to do your weeding in the row. And so when he first planted sunflowers, we had to hoe it, and he would hire people to hoe the weeds in the sunflowers, and then he would cultivate as good as he could with whatever we had down through the rows. But I mean, 1961. 75 acres or 125 acres of sunflower. We had wheat that went 13. It was a drought. Sunflowers went 12. 100 on one field and 1,500 on the other field at 7 cents a pound, my dad had won the lottery.
All right, Harry Siemens he's actually in Winnipeg today. Thanks for the update, Harry. We'll look forward to your forthcoming reports.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity and letting me in this short notice.
Okay, good. We'll talk to Harry Siemens again soon. Well, for about a year now, traffic on Highway 16 going southeast from Yorkton might have been puzzling over a row of pull-type combines parked adjacent to the highway. Well, you're on the land guy, that would be me, has figured it out. How about that? Those relics of the farming era past are the personal collection of former Yorkton-based custom harvester Al Kuntz. Kuntz and his wife Marilyn live near Yorkton and Acreage, and they were amongst the crazy Canucks who for years made that trek to somewhere south of the 49th parallel, usually Texas, to begin part of the U.S. winter wheat harvest, and these days, of course, canola and other crops as well. Now, the Kuntz are farm toy collectors, and they're major supporters of that annual show event here in February. Now, Al Kuntz says a family conversation began his quest to collect a model of every pull-type combine ever made.
So slowly over the years, I've bought one here at an auction sale, bought another one at an auction sale, had one donated to me, and it's, I think the collection has grown now to about 10 out there.
And so, just roughly, what geographic area did you pull these from? All from the Yorkton area?
Yeah, pretty well. I think the farthest I've gone is to Duff, for one. I would say pretty well. The rest have been all, you know, within, and then I think the other is Langenberg the other way. South, I've gone down to Walgreen to get a couple. And then I bought two at the auction place out at Yorkton there. Yeah, I think that's where most of them came from, all around. Pretty well, Duff would probably be the farthest away.
So have you reached your goal yet? Have you got one of everything?
No, I need about 8 or 9 more. I was kind of looking through my books here, and I think I need 9 more to get one of every brand that was, or every model that was made. I mean, there's some really, really old ones, but I'm sure those have all gone to the scrap heap, but I have a couple more I got to pick up. I just bought one here a couple weeks ago out in Gilbert Plains for $200, and it's a Versatile, that big transaxle 2000. I don't know if you're familiar with those, Jack, but it's too far to drive with my tractor, so I think I'm going to borrow my brother's gravel truck to pull it home because it's a pretty big combine, and I paid $200 for it. I couldn't believe the guy sold it to me for that little amount.
Well, I suppose at this point you did him a favor by just...
Well, that's kind of what he said. He said he had an auction sale this spring, and then it was a live auction. It got canceled because of course, the whole COVID thing, and he didn't even get a bid on it. And a fellow that I know through my other hobby with farm toys out at Gilbert Plains, he phoned me and said, "Hey, my neighbor's got a Versatile. I don't know if you'd be interested in it." So we went out and took a look at it one Sunday afternoon, and I said to him, I says, "Yeah." He says, I can't pay you much." He says, "Well, make me an offer." So I said, "How's $200 sound?" He says, "Sold. You're the proud owner."
Well, I guess I'm surprised, Al, that there were that many different companies making them.
Well, like, you know, Massey Ferguson, for instance, they've got about, I think I've got every model of Massey Ferguson. You know, they had about 4 models of their own that they made over the years, you know. John Deere, I'm missing one John Deere yet of the models they made. And IH, I've got, they made a couple, the same model number, but one had a kind of a red top hopper and the other one had a white top hopper. The Co-op Implements brand, I got one of those. I'm missing one more, the orange one that they made. Let's see, what else am I looking? Well, this Versatile, I need it to end my, or to help my collection out. And then there's what I call the Holy Grail, and it was the last full-type combine ever made. It was by John Deere, and it was a 9501. But those ones, I've only seen 2 in real life, and I mean, they still probably command $10,000 or $15,000 at an auction sale because guys with cattle really like them to bail up the straw behind them. And then they were built until 1991, I think, or 1990, and then they quit building them.
Well, how well did they work as far as thrashing and so forth?
Oh, they worked fine. I mean, in fact, I had one fella I talked to him this winter. He found out they were mine, and he wanted to buy the 852 Massey that I had there. He says, that's a better combine than what I'm using right now to combine my half section. And I said, I don't want to sell it. He says, why not? And he told me, he says, mine's a really good combine, but it's just, the tin is just wearing out on it. You know, he says, it's always worked good and everything, but it's just, I'm using it so much, the tin just, you know, it wears out. And he was going to buy it from me, and I said, well, I'd pay $300 for it. And I said, if I had to take any of them to the field and actually use them, that's the one I would take, because the guy I bought it from, he had just used it about a week before I bought it, the combine, 80 acres of barley, and he says it works fine, you know. They all, in their day, they were a good combine. There was nothing wrong with them, and they were a good idea, but eventually they just kind of fell by the wayside. I mean, IH and Case IH made that 1682, which I think was about 1987 was the last year they made them. You still see a few of them out in the countryside, and those are big combines. You know, you need a big tractor in front to run them, and they got a lot of capacity, and they'll do a very good job.
So am I correct? So some of the models, early models in particular, had an engine on them, had a motor, and then later they became PTO. Am I correct?
Yeah, you are, Jack. I don't have any with motors on. I mean, those are really hard to find. I mean, there's only two companies that I know that had them, McCormick, or which later became International, and the Baldwins, which later became Gleaner, you know. Those are the only two that I'm aware of that had motors on it. I've just seen pictures of them. I haven't seen a real one yet, but.
Well, I'm testament. I can tell you that centuries ago, Al, a friend of mine in Manitoba combined with a Minneapolis Moline pole type.
Oh, okay. With a motor on it.
Yes.
So that's a conversation with Al Kuntz. The Kuntz collection of pole type combines is visible from Highway 16 south and east of Yorkton. Now, according to a recent Grain News feature article about these combines, it says, and I'm quoting here, generally believed the Holt Company in Stockton, California, sold the first commercial combine in North America in 1886. And get this, it was a 14-foot cut ground drive machine pulled by up to 14 horses. The times they have changed, and of course we move on. Well, things have changed, of course, as everyone knows, with the COVID pandemic, and that includes auctions. The move to online auctions accelerated under the COVID social separation interval. And we spoke recently with Jamie Moore of Yorkton Auction Center about that.
You and I spoke at sort of more or less at the beginning of the pandemic impact here. What has changed in auctioneering over the last 6 weeks or so?
Yeah, so the biggest change obviously is just going from live auctions to strictly online. Whether it's live simulcast or an online timed auction, for ourselves personally in our business, we have chosen to go with the online timed auction. So that's the biggest change. And then obviously just, you know, having a certain number of people in the office at a time for loadouts and cash outs and stuff like that. So our customers are experiencing a bit of a wait time, but they're very patient and understanding. So
just explain what timed auction versus simulcast is.
Yeah, so a timed auction, it obviously just runs for a certain amount of time. Everyone's familiar with eBay. It's been around for quite a while. That's essentially a timed auction. So it starts on a certain day, and then the bidding is open for a certain time period, with bids closing at a set date and time. A live simulcast auction would be a live auctioneer selling over the internet to bidders who are at home on the computer or on their phone, bidding through the platform wherever they might be.
And I guess farmers are well acquainted with the process before we heard about a pandemic or COVID-19. But so they've obviously adjusted easily to this transition, if I could put it in those terms.
Yeah. I mean, it's a change for everyone, no doubt. There's still a lot of people that, you know, wish the live auctions were still available at this time, but there is also a vast majority that are comfortable with the online side and the conveniences that it brings to their bidding and, you know, buying the gear that they need for their operation. So it's been a good reception to the change. It's kind of a forced change. The industry was, I would say, headed in the direction of more online, and this would have expedited the process.
Yeah, I think you mentioned to me earlier that the Yorkton Auction Center had been going down that road for some time.
Yes, we started. We've done live auctions with online bidding since 2010, and then the timed auctions we started in 2017 on a small scale with our general merchandise and our small goods, and then we've steadily increased it into vehicles over the last number of years, and machinery and business closeout liquidations, and then obviously this year was our big foray into the RV auction as well as our April spring consignment sales. So.
So as far as farm auctions are coming up this summer, well, we're already into the season, I guess. Any particular anecdotes that come to mind that you might want to share about the process?
No, so there's still, for us anyways, for farm auctions, there's still going to be viewing available in our yard and the farm. We do have a couple farm sales here in August. So there'll be a select dates when viewing is available. Obviously we encourage that because you can't be there on sale day in the ring or in the farmer's yard. So it's very much encouraged to view stuff prior to a sale day and then bid online. So that would be the biggest thing.
So that, again, a conversation with Jamie Moore of Yorkton Auction Center. And Jamie and his dad, Paul, auctioneers and a family operation there. And just recently conducted a large auction sale near Sulcoats. And I believe last week a former Hudson Bay company building right in downtown Yorkton. Well, thanks for joining us on The Land from the Rock, and our producer, Jordan Patswold, as always, pulling the strings that keeps it together for us. I'm Jack Dawes.